From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, we follow soldiers training for war in the Mojave Desert.
If we see a new enemy tactic, we seek to train it here.
Also, California's drought could have us all paying more for groceries, but farm workers are already suffering.
The ordinary citizen here is going to be facing some of the most drastic situations that I've seen.
And in his latest project, musician Jordi Savall takes on the music of the Balkans.
Serbian musicians, Bosnian musicians. Jordi's crazy to bring all these people together.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Those aren't real bullets being fired. They're blanks. In fact, everything around me right now, this village where I'm standing, is fake. The town has everything an ordinary town would have. There are houses, shops, there's a marketplace with goods. They're made out of plastic, but it's bread and meat and vegetables. There's a mosque and a hotel and armed insurgents. It looks like we're in Afghanistan. It's actually a U.S. Army base in the middle of the Mojave Desert, the Fort Irwin National Training Center.
I see two observers up there, so we don't want to go any further that way.
Okay.
We end up in the middle of a bunch of guys with rifles.
Range op requests move from current grade back to garrison, please.
If you want to see how a decade of war has profoundly changed the way we train our soldiers to fight, this is where you come. As the U.S. combat mission in Afghanistan winds down, we came to find out how the end of the wars would change the mission here. That's our cover story today. Even though no real rounds are being fired, there are explosive charges. It's not safe for us to stay here. Our main destination is a place where they are using live rounds, which makes sense if you're trying to simulate war as closely as possible. Colonel Cameron Cantlin makes producer Rebecca Hersher and me don flak jackets and helmets before we get into his armored vehicle.
Feel safer?
Yeah. Colonel Cantlin commands the Army's 3rd Cavalry Regiment. They're training here in Fort Irwin before their final deployment to Afghanistan. We're driving through the Mojave Desert, about halfway between Los Angeles and Las Vegas, but many of the soldiers we talk to tell us there are parts of the desert here that are indistinguishable from Afghanistan. At a checkpoint, a sign in red reads, "Danger, live fire in progress." The base is huge. We drive about 35 miles through a number of regions with made-up names, past the fake city of Shark Darwaza Jamia, and north into Ertabat District, until we arrive at Goat Mountain.
Drop ramp. Okay, well, we'll go up to the top here.
It's one of the many mock villages here at NTC. And they took this mock village, they turned it into both for live fire and for blank fires. We could practice going in and out of buildings, in and out of rooms in these buildings. Really, it's a great little training facility.
We walk up a gravelly hill toward the buildings. But before we get to the top, I see something that stops me. It's a body in a soldier's uniform lying on the ground next to a stretcher. A few steps closer, and we can see it's a dummy. Colonel Cantlin explains it's a leftover from an earlier exercise, another part of the full immersion combat simulation.
Down here, this part of the training is loading a casualty into these trucks. We have a lot of what we call boulage kits, replicate the weight, the size. We had one yesterday, it was almost too real for some soldiers. There was an explosion next to one of the generators, and the soldiers ran out there, and the training center hires amputees, and then using moulage kits, when the soldiers respond, they come to a scene where there's people dressed in uniform and, you know, they're screaming in pain and it looks absolutely real. You can't beat that kind of training, although it is hard. I mean, there are some soldiers that really were disturbed, but you're always better to go through that here for the first time than somewhere else for the first time.
We continue up the hill. Cantlin explains that today, his men and women are practicing for a situation that has been deadly for both soldiers and civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, clearing a structure that contains a mix of innocents and combatants. It's incredibly high stakes. Hesitate, and you could die. Pull the trigger too fast, and you could kill a child.
This one is tailored for what we call the insider threat, which is training soldiers to deal with a situation that goes from normal to a situation where they have to defend themselves rapidly. We'll get Chanstock soldiers up here. Good sight.
For this exercise, the soldiers will clear a one-story house on the top of this hill. It's meant to be an office where the soldiers had been sent to talk to locals and then face an ambush. The building is sort of like a Hollywood set, but instead of there being no fourth wall, there's no roof. For the same reason as a Hollywood set. These exercises are filmed and reviewed, the same way NFL coaches review game tape.
Good luck. Be safe.
Okay, so Green Angel.
The exercise begins with normal introductions before the situation suddenly turns violent.
Ah, like a salam.
Sure thing.
Ah, yes.
One, two!
Eagle
coming in!
Bang, 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 bang!
One, what do you got?
The soldiers check all of the rooms, moving through the office and shooting at mannequins. When they've cleared the building, they debrief and then do it again and again. Each team does this exercise at least four times until it's second nature. Every soldier in the squadron gets a turn, even if they won't see direct combat.
My name is Maritz Bel Mustafa. I will be the logistical officer for the SFAT team, AUP Provincial.
Captain Mustafa is one of the few soldiers we encounter who will be going to Afghanistan for the first time. Her job there will be to work with and train Afghan uniformed police. That means a lot of interacting with locals in potentially sensitive circumstances. She's been learning about Afghan culture and customs and more subtle things like the way body language is different there.
Well, for me, it gives me a better perspective of my security forces that will be, you know, in charge of protecting us downrange as we go and conduct key leader engagements.
What's it like? Have you had the situation where you're interacting with these actors who are portraying locals and that sort of thing?
Oh, that definitely gives me a perspective into what we're going into. It helped me come up with the techniques to engage them, talk to them, and understand their culture at the same time.
We heard over and over how tailored this training is to specific situations these soldiers will face in Afghanistan, from the realistic villages and cities to the stark terrain to the bloody fighting. This is a mini Afghanistan. Major General Ted Martin is the commander in charge of the center.
If you were to go back in time to the National Training Center pre-9/11, it was called Heavy Metal Combat. There were 14 days in the octagon, and it was a clean battlefield, and it was clean in that there was friendly and enemy and nothing in between. No cities, nothing to get in the way. Actually, the towns and villages here were a direct result of lessons learned from the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan, that we need to learn how to fight in an urban environment, how to also peacefully coexist.
Now, that's got to be sort of tough, because you come out of a period where we've had two major conflicts where over time we figured out what we're dealing with, and now I can't imagine that it would still make sense to have training in mock Iraqi or mock Afghan villages.
Oh, well, see, I disagree with you on that. We're not going to lose these cities. We're not going to give it up, and we're not going to give. It doesn't matter what flavor as long as they speak a different language, have a culture you have to study, you know, they just kind of happen to look a little bit like Middle Eastern cities. It doesn't really matter. We can change the name of the cities. Mm-hmm. In fact, we do frequently. If it's in the old Iraqi days, they had a particular name, and now they have an Afghan name, and in the future, we'll move to probably change them to another name, just to keep people thinking.
But it will take more than a name change. The cities we saw were complete with mosques, signs everywhere in Arabic. Actual Afghans have been hired to live in the fake towns and cities, playing the parts of locals, village elders, and insurgents. To give this sprawling fort a makeover, transform it into something other than an ultra-realistic desert training ground, will be costly. But in the absence of a specific conflict, General Martin says that some changes have already begun. Now that the last Afghan-bound brigade has come through, Fort Irwin is focusing on the tactics of tomorrow.
We have to be prepared for an uncertain future. Our job is to, you know, if we see a new enemy tactic, we seek to train it here. We could look at, would you think that a brigade combat team would have to worry about cyber warfare? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we train now. And I never would have thought 10 years ago that we would do that.
The training center has also been bolstering chemical and biological weapons training for the soldiers. All of this costs money, a lot of money. The military's training budget is in the billions of dollars, but the budget is shrinking. Last year, sequestration cuts forced the National Training Center to cancel almost a quarter of its training rotations. And Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has announced the size of the Army will shrink dramatically in the coming years.
Our recommendations favor a smaller and more capable force, putting a premium on rapidly deployable, self-sustaining platforms that can defeat more technologically advanced adversaries.
Todd Harrison is a military budget expert at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He doesn't see any evidence that the Army is actually getting more targeted in the way Hagel envisions. In fact, he sees training centers like the one at Fort Irwin going back to traditional, very broad training, despite looming budget cuts.
They talk about it as full-spectrum operations. So they're going to be training troops for a wide variety of contingencies, everything from, you know, combined arms operations, you know, tank battles and that nature, all the way over to, you know, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism type operations and operating in a chemical environment or biological environment. And I think in the future years, as funding becomes more constrained, we may need to focus that training more on the most likely scenarios and maybe tailor it so that not all units get the same training, kind of a specialization, if you will, in readiness.
Readiness is a word we heard over and over at the National Training Center. It's more than a buzzword. Real readiness means that when combat occurs, fewer soldiers and fewer civilians die. But when it comes to potential threats, the list of scenarios the military could prepare for is almost infinitely expandable. The enemy could be insurgents or a regular army. The terrain could be anything imaginable, including outer space or cyberspace. How many different scenarios the military can realistically prepare for, that's a question the President and Congress will need to settle. Usually when I do an interview, I'm the one asking the questions. But when I sat down with writer Douglas Copeland this week, he had some questions for me.
Have you ever tried to get rid of a body?
Not a human body, no. Some I was unqualified to answer.
Why do different parts of the body taste different? Why does liver taste like liver, and why does tongue taste like tongue?
And for some reason, this.
Have you ever done a musical?
Like high school kind of stuff.
I can't say.
I like karaoke.
I live in fear of karaoke. My God, we're digressing. Okay.
Digressing from our real topic, Copeland's new novel. It's called Worst Person Ever. It's a profane and shocking book that centers around a completely loathsome individual named Raymond Gunt.
Okay, imagine there was this really bitter English guy who had Tourette's and swore all the time, except he doesn't have Tourette's. He just swears a lot, like a lot, to the point where it almost becomes like performance art.
Raymond is struggling to pay off debt he's acquired, making bad decisions in his miserable life. So he ends up taking a job as a cameraman on a remote island for a reality show.
Which is an extremely thinly veiled version of Survivor, which is a show I love, by the way.
Raymond has no idea what he's getting into. He also has no clue that he really is the worst person ever.
Of course, he thinks of himself as being like Jason Bourne, except he doesn't have a chin over the course of the book. Every woman he's ever really done wrong in his life magically appears one by one until they're all, and hope this doesn't spoil things, trapped on an island together.
And Raymond, as you said, he doesn't really think he's done anyone wrong. He tends to blame the world for what happens to him.
Oh, no, he thinks he's a fine, upstanding citizen, you know. Oh, by the way, now, I just realized I would like you to say, if you could, right now, that you found the book funny.
I found the book hilarious. I laughed out loud a bunch of times.
I wanted to, like, leverage that it was funny out of you, because books editors can do this really naughty thing where they take a book and they give it to the complete wrong person to review it, which means a great review, but it just makes life difficult for the person on the receiving end.
It was hilarious. I don't remember the last time I read a novel and laughed out loud so many times.
Music to my ears.
Okay. But I let me tell you, though, that while it was hilarious and while I literally couldn't put it down.
You were entertained against your will.
I was entertained. Well, maybe there's part of that, because I don't quite know how I feel about this book. Which, meaning that it's hilarious, but it's 300 pages of vulgarity, almost without lapse.
I try and taunt myself as things progress.
Do you think it's an unfair description?
My editor did say, like, well, can Raymond just have Tourette's? And that way it becomes cute and funny. It's like, no, he's just English, and this is what he does.
You know, I've already seen some reviews of this book, and you've been attacked for it, because Raymond comes across, at least, as misogynist and homophobic and misanthropic and, yeah, all these horrible things. And I don't know a lot about you, but just from what you've written and things that you've said, I don't think that you're those things.
Well, that's sort of like, is Angela Lansbury an axe murderer?
Right.
It's the thing about characters, and this is weird. And I mean, I've been doing this for 14 books now, is you start writing a book, and then about a quarter of the way in, usually, the characters basically write the book itself, and you're just sitting there channeling it. And so in the case of Raymond, dum-da-dum-da-dum, like, oh my God, I can't believe he just did that. Wait, technically I just did that, didn't I? What's going on here? And that was, of all the characters I've done, he's the one that I don't know where he came from or whatever. He's just like, bleh.
In a way, I find that comforting, because if you were here telling me that, oh yeah, Raymond, I know that guy, I'd be a bit concerned.
I have no idea where, that's characters in general.
Well, you're a literary writer, and again, I couldn't close this book. I felt like there's a point to this, but it's not like, there's no redemption.
There's no socially redeeming value whatsoever. Every book I do is different from the ones that preceded it. Everything new should offer some chance to change the reader in some way. And with this book, kind of want you to feel like, what would it be like to be hit from fire hoses from seven different directions at full blast, and then they turn off, and you're sort of standing there kind of like tingly and little cartoon stars sort of flying around the top of your head. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is just because things have been sort of grim in a lot of ways, and there's sort of this epidemic of earnestness, and why not just go against that trend and write something that might actually damage a person's soul if they read it?
So, thank you for damaging my soul.
The opposite. What's the opposite of a vitamin? It's like a
detriment. Or
no, it's like one of those hamburgers that has like chicken with like two meat patties as a bun. It is that.
Douglas Copeland, it's been a wild pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thanks so much.
Douglas Copeland's new novel is called Worst Person Ever. A few weeks ago, I rode shotgun in Cannon Michael's pickup truck. His family has been farming for six generations.
Yeah, my great-great-great-grandfather came over from Germany in the 1850s.
Michael now runs an 11,000-acre farm in California's Central Valley. It's a multi-million dollar operation where you can find a lot of your grocery store basics. Tomatoes, onions, melons. But today, he's pretty pessimistic about his work.
It is going to be a year that's, you know, probably at best maybe break even, you know, or maybe lose some money.
Michael tells me about one-fifth of the land will lie fallow this year, unfarmed. So come harvest season, he won't be able to hire as many people to work the fields.
This year, maybe a third of the guys will have laid off. Probably 20 guys maybe we won't bring in.
The reason that Michael and farmers all around the valley are cutting back? California's severe ongoing drought.
Without surface water, it's a big strain, and people are finding whatever means they can to survive.
That's our cover story today. When a region lives on water, what do people do when the land dries up? Chances are you eat food grown in California. Nearly half of the country's fruits, nuts, and vegetables come from here, a state that's dried up. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, the entire state of California is considered abnormally dry. Two-thirds of California are in extreme to exceptional drought conditions. Producer Tom Dreisbach and I drive from Los Angeles to the Central Valley, and the change in terrain is dramatic. We go abruptly from mountains to the flat farmland. All of a sudden, it's like we're in Nebraska. Earlier this year, many farmers here found out they would get no irrigation water from state and federal water projects. Recent rains have helped a little. On Friday, government officials said there was enough water to give a little more to some of the region's farmers, 5% of the annual allocation instead of what they were getting, zero. Ken and Michael tells us his farm has been a little bit luckier. Because of their long history here, his family has what are called senior water rights and a stronger guarantee to the region's water. Those rights mean they're getting 40% of their normal water allocation, and sprinklers are still spraying water across some of the soil. But the farm has still had to cut back. We can see many fields that are laying fallow or growing a placeholder crop to keep the soil from eroding. Thanks to the drought, much of his wheat crop is not suitable for human use, so it's already been cut to make hay for livestock. And as a consequence of all this, Cannon tells me they're buying less equipment, like big tractors.
We had ordered one last year in October, anticipation of using it this spring, and they called me a couple weeks ago and said that it was here, and I said, you know, we just, based on the outlook for this year, you know, we just can't take it.
And we're talking a tractor with a serious price tag.
About $400,000, $350,000.
Stories like his are playing out throughout the Central Valley. With less water, farmers are making fewer big purchases. They're fallowing hundreds of thousands of acres and hiring fewer farm laborers, putting less money into the local economy. Economists say it's too early to accurately predict the drought's effect on jobs, but it's likely several thousand will be lost, maybe as many as 20,000. That might not sound like a lot, but many of those workers are already living paycheck to paycheck and live in communities that depend on that work. We stopped for lunch at Cecilia's, a small Mexican restaurant in the farming town of Mendota. About 11,000 people live here, not far down the road from Fresno. There's a sweet, small-town feel to the place. Everyone seems to know each other. The majority of the people here work in agriculture. Sarah Morales' family owns Cecilia's restaurant. She tells us the drought has brought hard times.
Right now, it's like there's days where it's 12 o'clock and it's dead. And there's some really good days, but there's no tallying right now.
It was pretty quiet when we visited. But David Barajas was there eating lunch. He works for Mendota's water department. He tells us he's had to turn off people's water more and more lately, not because of the shortage, but because people can't afford to pay their bills.
We get a lot of shutoffs right now. Yeah.
It's from people not paying?
Oh, yeah, not paying, yeah.
How long do they get to go before you have to shut it off?
About two months.
The ordinary citizen here is going to be facing some of the most drastic situations that I've seen.
Robert Silva is the town's mayor. He tells us Mendota struggles even in wet years. Nearly half of the people here live below the poverty line. Unemployment often hovers around 30%. They've been through bad droughts before, the last hit in 2009, brutally coinciding with the nation's foreclosure crisis. Mayor Silva's been thinking a lot about that year recently.
We know exactly more or less what's going to happen because we saw what happened. We experienced these bad problems. Crime went up. There was a lot of spousal abuse, a lot of expulsions in the school system, result of those people not working.
Silva tells me it's been especially hard for men and women used to working hard in food production to turn around and stand in food lines for handouts. Most hiring happens during the harvest season, closer to the summer. So people here say the worst is yet to come.
Okay. And to go for here?
That's for here.
For here. And to drink?
A few blocks from Mayor Silva's office, Wanda Long is taking orders at Lucky Chinese Restaurant. More than three decades ago, Long left China and came to the U.S. She ended up settling in Mendota, and she and her husband started the restaurant with high hopes.
Make a living, better life. That's our dream. I come from China. You know.
Long has seen hard times before, but she tells us this year is different. People here don't have a lot of money to begin with, and now they're too scared to spend it.
It's 31 years already. That's the worst year, I tell you. Even people come, you know, they tell me, no money, Wanda. I ask them, you want something to eat? He said, oh, no, just a cup of coffee. And he says, no hay dinero, no trabaja, no agua.
How long can you manage like this?
I don't have no idea. That's what I told my customer. Sometimes I can't even cover all the expenses. And I don't know how long we could, you know, manage a situation like that, actually, you know.
As we drive along Interstate 5, it's impossible to miss the drought. Dead almond trees, unattended fields. There are also signs everywhere along the road expressing anger about what people here call the water wars. Signs in Spanish and English say things like, no water equals no jobs, pray for rain, and Congress created Dust Bowl. Both the federal and state government have promised to help. President Obama has promised $183 million in federal funds for drought relief. California state government has put forward nearly $700 million on top of that. But farmers and local officials insist that more is needed. And one area that has officials worried is education. It's noon recess at Lorena Felasco Elementary School in Los Banos. Kids play tag and kick soccer balls around the playground.
Oh,
sorry. Danger zone.
That is Jane Brittell, the school's principal. We dodge balls to make our way to her office. She tells us she's worried the drought will force families to leave and pull their kids out of school.
We have, you know, an agricultural community, and even if the students' parents aren't involved in the agricultural field, the community is. So when that starts to dry up and there's not the, you know, money generated for the businesses, employment starts to dwindle, and then parents have to move for better jobs, more jobs.
And it happens when it happens. You don't have tons of notice when a family has to leave, right?
It makes it very difficult. Our enrollment can drop. We can have what we call a revolving door where students will disenroll and then, you know, new families will enroll and maybe stay for a few weeks. Parents might be trying to find employment and can't, and then they move on. And that's very difficult for the education of the children.
And obviously, when a student has to leave, when their family has to leave the community, that's the last part of the process. But getting up to that stage, there have to be a lot of stresses on the family and on the students. How do you see that with the kids in the school?
It's hard on kids. When we had the economic recession several years ago, I had kids whose parents couldn't afford the gas to come back to Los Banos because they were commuting over to San Jose to work. Some families were living in their cars, and we really reach out to those families and try to help, but it's very, very hard on the students and very stressful.
The superintendent of Los Banos Unified School District is a guy named Steve Teachin.
We could lose up to 5% of our students, which for a 10,000 student school district, which is what we are, you know, we're talking about 500 kids.
California distributes education funding in part based on attendance. So losing students means losing dollars after years of cutbacks.
We're still deficit spending this year. So if we were to lose 500 kids, 500 students, that's somewhere around $3 million that we would be out. And that's another way to look at, you know, how many teachers would you have to cut to save $3 million? That's another part of the equation we have to look at.
Teachin says that would mean laying off as many as 20 teachers in the district. At least this year, he won't have to make that decision. The California Department of Education says it's going to work with schools hit hardest by the drought to make sure they don't lose funding. Back on the streets of Mendota, Sergio Valdez shows us around town.
This is our center right here, the old library.
Valdez works part-time for the city council and manages local youth programs. He grew up here. He's proud of his town. While there's talk of people leaving to find jobs elsewhere, he tells us he's staying.
It's a little town. It's home. You know, it's home for us.
Valdez's parents left Mexico to work in the fields here. And he worries that the new group of people moving to the Central Valley won't have the same chance to succeed.
People are coming in, but are they going to make it? And that's the key. You have to have people working.
Still, there's a reason he's staying. He believes in Mendota.
They say, oh, we're going to become a ghost town, we're going to drive. No, Mendota will continue to live. I mean, it's not going to be as big and prosperous as everybody wants. We'll be like the little train that said, I think I can. Woo-woo, you know.
He says every town has its problems, and right now in Mendota, they're waiting to find out just how bad the drought will get. Again, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Christine Jensen says she has multiple personalities. She's a saxophonist, a composer, leader of a jazz group, and more recently, the conductor of an 18-piece jazz orchestra. That requires yet another personality, a businesswoman, to make a generally unprofitable venture work.
It's not like the pop industry where it's an investment that's going to most likely pay off. It is really hard to get it to the public unless you're touring all the time, and obviously with a big band that's really hard.
Christine Jensen's latest album is called Habitat. This piece, Intersection, is the first time she'd ever attempted to write specifically for a big band.
At the time I was playing a lot with sextets and quintets, and everyone said, oh, that piece is so nice, you should arrange it for a big band. And I'm like, oh my God, that's so much work. 18 people, that's a lot of people to think about. Gradually, once I got comfortable doing a few things, I challenged myself to write something that creates a journey, and I was basically trying to find a concept where I was featuring many different soloists in different corners of the piece. So you hear a bit of small group to large group to solo piano. There's a lot of different textures in this piece.
You're a great saxophone player, but this is not the typical jazz big band that you think of where, you know, the person is fronting and playing their own horn. You actually, when I've seen you, most of your times your hands are too busy conducting to be picking up a horn. Is there something about this music? Is it too difficult to conduct and play at the same time?
There is definitely a challenge there. It depends, I guess. You know, I think of an album, each piece to me is a short story, and maybe I'm involved in it as a player, maybe I'm involved in it as a conductor of the music, and that word conducting is a very strong word for me. So I'm in the music as the composer, conductor, and sometimes the player. But I also feel that the large ensemble jazz setting for me is also balancing that beautiful spur-of-the-moment thing that happens in jazz with the soloists and with the rhythm section. Mm-hmm. And then there's this ensemble writing. So where I place the soloists or myself is all about finding a fine balance between the two things.
Well, there's one track we get to hear you play soprano sax on. That's Suite Adelphi. What is it like? Because I know you've talked about the headspace of a composer and the headspace of an improviser being almost distinct. So what's it like smashing those two together?
Well, that's when I get to be in the moment. Suite Adelphi is also kind of one of the first pieces I wrote for Ingrid and me, my sister, she's a trumpet player, Ingrid Jensen, and mm-hmm. I distinctly remember sitting on the street, which is Adelphi Street in Brooklyn in Fort Greene, mm-hmm. and it was a beautiful spring day, and I just wrote the motive down super fast, and she was in the other room going, oh, that's really pretty, keep going. There was a few other pieces on this album where I thought I would be able to play. The first track is called Tree Lines, and I originally thought my sister and I would be having this big conversation over this piece, but in the end, I really had to conduct more than play at that point.
Well, talking about your sister, Ingrid Jensen, for people who are not familiar with jazz, she's a fantastic trumpet player, has been on the scene for a while. So as you're working as the architect of this music, how do you deploy Ingrid, like in a tune like Tree Lines?
Oh, that's a good question. Tree Lines, I found, was something where I was working on character development a little bit and how you have to balance between the soloist and the ensemble. It's a tricky thing. I think that's why some of my songs are a bit too long. But I find deploying her is a great word. Every take we do, I'm just trying to lay out some things for her so she can have this freedom to do what she likes on top of my music.
Let's talk about the track Tumble Down. That's about your travels in Haiti. Can you talk about what inspired that piece?
That I wrote quickly out of the spirit of the moment of the sadness I felt when I heard about that devastating earthquake.
This was the earthquake in Haiti in 2010.
Yeah, thank you. 2010. And I'd been there the previous years, a few years back, 2007 and 2008. It was a visit where I felt there was so much hope and so much of a future in terms of infrastructure ahead of them. I think I met the most beautiful people in my life from all my travels by going to Port-au-Prince. And then you know, a few years later, I'm sitting in a residency in at the Banff Center for Fine Arts, and I was trying to write some music, and I couldn't believe this earthquake had hit and kind of wiped out what I thought was some structure that was going to start happening in this place. So that, you know, it's amazing that there's a place this close to North America and how third world it is when you look at it. And to know that it went deeper into this dark place after an earthquake. But I do know that, you know, after meeting these people, they're so resilient and so positive and so beautiful that that's sort of the journey of that piece for me.
That saxophonist, composer, and bandleader Christine Jensen. Her new album is called Habitat. Christine, thank you so much. It was a blast talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Here at All Things Considered, we've created a place to sit and talk about kids and everything to do with being a parent. Have a seat at the kids' table. Every parent is thrilled when their child says their first word. When they say their first swear word, not so much. But that is a normal development when it comes to language. Dr. Timothy Jay is a psychologist and an expert in swearing. He says parents worried about bad words might be fighting a losing battle.
As soon as kids start talking, they pick up this kind of language. You know, they pick up the taboo words from hearing their parents or their siblings use it, and they're like little language vacuum cleaners, so they repeat what they hear. By the time they're heading off to school at 5 or 6, they have a pretty well-developed vocabulary of bad things to say.
So does that mean that kids are picking it up from their parents, or do we have a sense of where it comes from, where they acquire it?
They pick it up from their parents. You know, their parents will have rules against swearing in the house, but they still swear. They pick it up from their siblings, and certainly they pick it up from their peers.
So from a psychological perspective, is it bad to swear in front of kids?
No, it's. I think it's part of them learning about their emotions and emotional expression. If you looked at it as just a part of being angry or frustrated or happy or surprised, that is all normal. That's built into all of us.
So does that mean that I should just let my kids say whatever they want? And they'll be listening to this, by the way.
It's your job to teach your kids the nuances of this language. Like, well, it's okay to say that here. It's okay to say it in the house or in the backyard. You do want to teach them how to manage their emotions. And the language is just part of that. So try to figure out first why the kid is using this kind of language. Expect it to be there. Expect it, you know, your kids to be angry and frustrated at times. And sometimes this language seems kind of natural to them.
One of the things we tried with our kids, my wife and I started using substitute words. But the funny thing is they just adopt those. And in a way, it almost sounds worse to hear a four-year-old saying, Mom, the bath is too freaking hot.
Yeah, that euphemisms are pretty common. Sort of one of the other things underlying this is like, how are we going to talk about our bodies? How are we going to talk about what comes out of our bodies? How are we going to talk about sexuality? I tried to use with my daughter clinical terms, which are pretty acceptable anywhere. And then you don't have to have the burden of having two or three vocabularies, one that you use at home and one you use around mom and one you use around your friends.
You write that the positive consequences of swearing are commonly disregarded in the media.
We're trying to develop the social science, the cognitive science of swearing. And it affronts, I think, the major perception of this as sort of a moral, religious view of bad language or dirty words. A lot of times you don't get to the argument about the positive uses of these. So certainly their use in humor, their use in bonding, their use as a relief from pain or venting frustration. I look at this as an evolutionary advantage. Why would we have this language? It must do something for us.
Would you help me write a letter to the FCC?
Yeah, I'd be happy to write a letter to the FCC.
Excellent. We'll get in touch about that. That's psychologist Timothy Jay, an expert in cursing. Dr. Jay, thank you.
Well, I'm darn glad to be here.
Now we're going to talk about one of the weirdest paradoxes in math. And don't worry if you hate math. Here's the weirdness in a nutshell. Say you have a line in space. It's 1 inch long. And you want to divide it. Easy. You cut it in half, cut that half in half, and so on and so on. But at some point, you get to something so small you can't cut anymore. All those infinitely small things make up your line. They're so small they have a length of zero, because if it were any more than that, you could just keep on dividing. But hang on, that's impossible, because even if you add up a billion zeros, you get nothing. What happened to our line? That is what used to blow math minds in the days before quantum physics and LSD. Now, if you're willing to ignore those troubling questions, you could actually get some pretty useful math, like calculus. Amir Alexander says the fight over how to resolve the paradox informed real fighting, 500 years of wars and dispute that produced modern Europe. In his new book, Infinitesimal, Alexander says not everyone was willing to go along, starting with the Jesuits.
They were coming really out of this crisis of the Reformation, where the old order and the church had been splintered apart. And their mission was to reestablish a proper hierarchical order. There was a Jesuit by the name of Christopher Clavius, and he believed that the answer is in mathematics, and particularly geometry, because geometry is orderly, it is absolutely certain, and once you get results in geometry, nobody can argue with you.
They're provable.
Everything is absolutely provable, and no sane person can ever dispute something like the Pythagorean theorem. He said, if we could have theology like that, then we get rid of all those pesky Protestants who keep arguing with us, right? Because we could prove things.
So to understand what was troubling about this paradox for the Jesuits and other representatives of this point of view, it was the fact that this could not be explained? Or was there something about the idea of something being so small it was indivisible?
It really was the fact that there is a paradox. There is basically a mistake at the heart of mathematics. Because the whole point of studying mathematics is because it is absolutely certain and everything is known, everything has its place, and there is a very orderly hierarchy of results there. And now in the middle of that, you throw this paradox and you can get all those strange results. That basically means that mathematics can't be trusted. And if mathematics can't be trusted, what else can? And the Jesuits, fought a long and hard campaign to try and wipe out this whole mathematical approach of infinitesimals.
Well, people have been arguing about it since the Greeks. Did they really think they could wipe this concept off the face of the earth?
They really did their best, and they succeeded very well in Italy. Italy was, before the 17th century and into the 17th century, it was really the mathematical capital of Europe. It had the greatest mathematician, the greatest mathematical tradition. It was the leader in mathematics.
Greatest astronomer.
Yeah, Galileo and mathematicians like Cardano and Commandino and others. It was a very, very impressive tradition of mathematics, the best in Europe. And by the time the Jesuits were done, that was gone, all of it. By the 1670, Italy was a complete backwater in mathematics and the sciences.
Let's jump to England, because this is another wild aspect of this, that you tie this in to basically the English Civil War.
Absolutely. Because in England, what happened was that during the Civil War, the whole social order was suddenly under threat. Those revolutionaries, those radical sects, all of them just bubbled up and threatened the established order that was dominated by the propertied classes. And again, there were two approaches to this. One of them was represented by Thomas Hobbes, mm-hmm. who is known today, of course, as a political philosopher. But at the time, he also considered himself a mathematician and was widely acknowledged as a mathematician. And he thought the only way to reestablish order was, much like the Jesuit, just wipe off any possibility of dissent. Establish a state that is absolutely logical, where the laws of the sovereign have the force of a geometrical proof. On the other side, his personal enemy and rival for almost three decades was John Wallace. And he believed that the chance for that kind of order is gone. What you have to build now is some space where dissent can be allowed, within limits at least, where not everything can be known at any given time, and build a society and build a social order from the ground up, rather than imposing it by one single law.
So if the Jesuits and Thomas Hobbes had won, had been able to shut the door on the infinitesimal, what would the Western world look like now, do you think?
Well, I think things would have been very different. I think if they had won, then it would have been a much more hierarchical society. There were certainly, in a world like that, there would not be room for democracy. There would not be room for dissent. Most likely, we would not have also all this great accomplishments that mathematics is at the heart of today. Modern science, modern technology, and everything from your cell phone to this radio station to airplanes to cars and trains is all fundamentally dependent on this technique of infinitesimals.
Amir Alexander, fascinating speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Amir Alexander teaches history at UCLA. His new book, Infinitesimal, is out now. Again, thanks for listening. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Jordi Savall has made a career of reviving ancient music. But when you go to a Jordi Savall concert, you have no idea what might happen, who might show up. You might see musicians from Afghanistan or Africa, and you might see those musicians perform an ancient French song or a Jewish lullaby. Because Savall doesn't just play music as museum piece recreations, he takes great pleasure in smashing together music from different times and different cultures. His latest project dives deep into the incredible variety of music that sprang from the Balkans. I met Jordi Savall backstage at LA's Disney Hall before a show. He has this peculiar quality of being somehow serene and intense at the same time. Savall told me about his fascination with the period when the Balkans were under the control of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Turks took the region in the 15th century and gave it the name Balkan. Now, what that name means, there's some dispute about that. Not surprisingly, Jordi Savall prefers the poetic explanation, a combination of two words, Baal and Khan.
Baal means in Turkish honey and Khan, blood. They found a beautiful country, but they found also a very strong population who resist in a very exceptional way. And they tell that this is the country of the honey and blood.
Jordi Savall says the Ottomans gave locals a certain degree of independence and tolerated religious and cultural differences. Because it was essentially a place where East meets West, the Balkans were ridiculously diverse, more than 20 distinct ethnic groups. It was a refuge for Jews expelled from Spain, so many styles of music that could all be played freely.
With no influences from the West, in this part of the world was no Renaissance, no Baroque.
A place outside of time.
Yeah, and that means the music that we hear today is exceptional rich from many cultures going back to the very ancient times.
And the music on this, it's like that music out of time. You know, that I feel like it could be 1,000 years ago, or there's sometimes that it feels like it swings like jazz.
Yeah, but this is very contemporary music because it's full of improvisation. It's music which is created in the moment.
As he studied the modern-day Balkans, Jordi Savall noticed how many cultural traditions remained where, in other places, they succumbed to globalization. One favorite example are the gypsy traditions that have faded elsewhere in Europe.
And the project, it's a way to reflect this extremely big diversity of ways to sing, to play music, to believe also. And this is, I think, for me, it's one of the most exciting projects I have done in the last 20 years.
te mandai molte piau. Mama hai te piau hai ti mandiavi, mama.
This is a project too big to contain on a record. The three CDs on Balkan come in a small coffee table friendly book, essays on the music, art, culture and history of the region, jammed full of photos and art reproductions. His last several projects have been issued this way, part of a master plan by Saval. In this day of downloads, he's trying to revive the idea of a record album as a thing you want to hold and experience.
And this is something you can take your time to read, to listen. I think it's also important to bring to the music all the elements to understand the music, to know about the history, about the political situation, what are these societies, what are these people, what they represent in our world today, you know?
And in our world today, it's impossible to shy away from political history. The 20th century saw a lot more blood in the Balkans. Different cultures don't mix so well anymore. Remarkably, the inspiration for this project came from a performance in memory of the victims of the siege in Sarajevo. For that concert, Jordi Saval had assembled a potentially volatile blend of ethnicities.
Serbian musicians, Bosnian musicians, Armenian musicians, Turkish musicians. Sephardic musicians, Christian musicians. Well, it was clear to see in the ambience was a certain electricity. Mm. People was there, happy to be there, but many of these people has never played together. Mm. And they looked at the others and we told, like this, what we can do. Jordi is crazy to bring all these people together. You know? Well, after rehearsal, 1 or 2 hours, the ambience has changed totally. The music has made him a miracle. What makes one musician is having sympathy to another musician. It's when he understands the other musician has the same language as he has, the same sensibility, the same virtuosity. Then it's a respect. And then it's creating something fantastic.
That's Jordi Saval. His latest project is called Balkan, Honey and Blood. We spoke just before a performance at LA's Disney Hall. For the week ending April 20th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is our technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.